position in the region, not only in the Persian part of the region, but also into the subcontinent. Iran has always been admired as a bridge between the cultures. So this culture of Nowruz can certainly enhance ties between different nations in the region. And it has been playing. And if I quote Allama Iqbal, that is also known as Iqbal Lahori in Iran and in the Persian region, and he always several times mentioned in his poetry that Iran could be the center of the Muslim and the world.
An important tradition observed on this day is the Nowruz prayers, which are held at the fire temples. People gather to offer their prayers and perform rituals, seeking blessings from God for the new year. Nowruz is also celebrated in Bangladesh, where the festival has its roots in the historical connection between East Bengal and the Mughal Empire. Shia Muslims in the country regard the day as sacred, holding special prayers in the homes. Nowruz highlights the importance of cultural heritage in shaping the identities of communities and nations.
The close link between the cultures of Iran and Kashmir suggests that the valley was hugely influenced by the Iranian customs and traditions and became a part of the huge Persian cultural realm. In the present-day Kashmir, the Muslim community, especially the Kashmiri Shias, celebrate Nowruz with fervor and zeal. Cleaning houses, buying new clothes, preparing elaborate meals are an important part of this spring festivity. Like in Iran, fish remains the most important part of the Nowruz meal.
Nowruz is a festival that has been common amongst the Asian Persians and Vedic Aryans of India. In the Kashmir Valley, the Kashmiri Brahmin community has been celebrating the day as Navre, which literally translates to New Day.
All the good thoughts, good words, and good deeds.
Even before the spread of Islam in the Himalayan Valley, the Kashmiri Brahmin community has been celebrating the festival in a similar manner as the Asian Persians. Since thousands of years, like the Iranian Haftsin, Tai Barun is part of the ceremony where seven items are displayed symbolizing fortune, health, wisdom, etc.
The religious rituals they are donated to this festival is also a very polite and it has very calmness and certainly it can also blended with culture can help disseminate the message of peace, harmony, and living together.
Historians and anthropologists have alluded this similarity to the presence of a modified form of Zoroastrian faith called as Avestan. This faith has its presence in Kashmir, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and some areas of northern Pakistan. Visit to families followed by invitations for lunch and dinner are central to the Nowruz celebration in the picturesque valley. Spending time in nature on Nowruz and the days following it is significant for Kashmiris. People frequent the famed gardens of the valley, take boat tours through the lakes. Plantation is considered auspicious on this day with a belief that the plants planted on Nowruz will produce a bountiful crop.
In Pakistan, Nowruz is celebrated by many communities, including Shias, Ismailis, Hazaras, Baluchis, and many more. According to some interpretations by Shia Muslims, Nowruz is a day when Imam Ali, peace be upon him, ascended the throne of the Imamate. Therefore, fasting on the auspicious day is recommended as a thanksgiving to God. Visiting the graves of the relatives is a central part of the Nowruz tradition amongst different cultures. On the day of March equinox, families gather around the Nowruz table to mark the beginning of the new year.
For people of Pakistan, Nowruz symbolizes purity and rebirth. This regeneration of earth is marked with activities such as planting trees and seeds, cleaning homes, and welcoming the new life in the form of spring air. People, especially children, dress in new clothes, indicating a fresh start. Among many communities, decorating eggs is an important part of the celebration as it symbolizes new life. According to the tradition, a large plate of silver or copper is filled with samani, an important Nowruz wreath delicacy. Samani is surrounded by candles and eggs representing members of the family. Seven-course meal is one of the noticeable features of this spring festival. Amongst many cultures spread across different countries, the four Tuesdays preceding Nowruz are dedicated to different universal elements. The first is Water Tuesday, celebrating how water renews nature. The next day is Fire Tuesday, celebrating fire as a means of renewal. Then there is Earth Tuesday, commemorating the rebirth of the planet. Finally, on the last Tuesday, the wind opening the flower buds signals the arrival of spring. Fire offerings are also an important aspect of the celebration, with flames lit on each of the four Tuesdays leading up to Nowruz. On the last Tuesday of, people jump over the fire as a cleansing ritual.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mrs. Ekta Kumar, a writer and journalist from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Kumar. Now, Nowruz, as a festival, has assumed a global character. So what geographical background can be ascribed to the celebration of Nowruz?
So, Nowruz is primarily an agrarian festival, right? That goes back centuries. And, I mean, clearly it belongs to your country. It started there. It has, it's a very secular festival that I think celebrated something that is so primal, right? Just a new crop, there's food to eat, and you celebrate it with those you love and those who are around you. I think when it goes back, there was a Zoroastrian king who kind of, Jamshed, who kind of initiated the whole thing. But the basis, I think, and this is something that resonates not just in Iran, but across the world. You know, we always celebrate a good harvest. You know, you celebrate the beginning of spring. And Nowruz, like you mentioned, the word itself, Nav is new and Roz is every day, is day. So literally, the name itself signifies, is symbolic of what it kind of celebrates. It's, we all look forward to rebirth. We look forward to starting again. We look forward to bounty. And we look forward to sharing it with those we love. So, so yes, the festival goes back a long, long time. It started off in the land where you belong. And now has kind of spread and been adopted in so many different ways, you know, across. It's not really restricted to your country anymore. I think we've all kind of taken a little bit and adopted it in our own way.
Mrs. Kumar, few people have been more closely related in origin and throughout history than the people of Iran and also the subcontinent. So how do you see these cultural ties between Iran and the South Asian region growing further?
So on paper, diplomatic ties were established only as recently as 1950, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years after independence. But I think that's just on paper. I mean, we go back clearly centuries, right? Because of trade, because of travel, because of exchange of people and ideas and cultures. The ties that we share really go back a very long way. Just to give you a quick story, you know, this is a story I think all of us in India are familiar with. When the Parsis kind of migrated and were looking for a place to stay, and they landed on the western coast of India, which is, you know, they came by sea. And when they landed on the western coast, the Indian ruler at that time said that, I believe, you know, the story goes, he held up a silver bowl full of milk. And he said, and it was overflowing, like it was full to the brim. And he looked and he said, you know what, our lands are overflowing with people. We have enough. And really, we don't want to. Give me one good reason why we should say yes to foreigners. Allow you to be here, to practice your faith. Why would we? We have too much already. And the story goes that the elders of the Zoroastrian community at that time picked up a pinch of sugar, which is sweet, and dropped it in the milk, and said, if you allow us to stay, we will be like the sugar in the milk. You know, we will dissolve completely and only sweeten the bowl that you're holding in your hand. And this is a story we've heard ever since we were children, and it is just such a beautiful story that kind of actually captures the state of affairs today. I mean, the story is very old. It supposedly happened hundreds of years ago. But the reason it resonates is because that is absolutely true for today. I mean, we're all the same. Nobody looks at each other any differently. We belong to the same country. Our traditions are different. But, you know, today, the Parsi community itself has contributed in so many ways to India.
Mrs. Kumar, let's talk about nature. It has always been a source of cultural merriment. So can Nowruz be used to create awareness about living in harmony with the nature?
You know, that is such an interesting question and so relevant in these times. I mean, this is something we need to remind each other again and again. Like you mentioned, nature is so simple, right? It absolutely forms the basic of who we are. And yet today, there are 8 billion of us, it's a large number, on this planet, buying things, consuming things, wasting things, constantly. I think we're all running for more and more and more. And we all need reminders to say what we have is enough. And actually, end of the day, like coming back to Navroz and the whole festival, what we really need is very basic, you know. Celebrate if you have a plate of hot food and you're sharing it with those you love and people around you with joy and happiness and optimism. I mean, that is all you really need. And yet, for most of us, I mean, for all of us, for that matter, we're constantly chasing more of things which I don't know if we really need. Sometimes I think we need reminders to say, hey, step back. And festivals are wonderful in the sense they give us that excuse, if I can use that word really, to say stop, look back and do things the way it was done thousands of years ago. And when you're, and those little rituals and traditions that you do, and we have them in India as well, right? You don't do it 364 days a year, but that one day or those few days that you do, it can be a wonderful reminder to say this is all our ancestors really needed, and perhaps this is all that we should be grateful for. You know, you have food to eat, you're safe, you're secure, you're with your loved ones. You don't really need the rest.
Mrs. Kumar, you mentioned the Parsis. Now, the Parsis in India have been holding on to the traditions and memories of their homeland. Do you see them acting as cultural ambassadors in future between the two nations?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is no doubt the world today, I mean, the increasingly fractured world that we live in today needs anybody who can kind of help bridge the differences and kind of fill the gaps a little bit. And like I was mentioning earlier, the Parsis do it so beautifully. Like you mentioned, you know, they hold on to their own traditions and they don't need to give up their identity. You know, they don't need to give up who they are. At the same time, they're such a beautiful example of assimilation, right? Of integration, of being just being able to live together and still do your own thing. So yes, when you ask me if they can be cultural ambassadors, absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt about the fact that they will help in kind of bringing India and Iran closer. But I do believe that it should not be restricted only to the Parsi community. End of the day, in India, they're fairly small in number. I think we need to involve a lot of other groups. You know, our political leaders need to be involved. We need to hear each other's music and artists, and we need to have storytellers from both sides. Just to give you, you know, today in the morning, I woke up for this interview and I was just excited because all my life, all through my childhood, I've heard these beautiful stories coming out of Persia and I've had books, fairy tale books that belong to your region. And today, just to be able to get a peek and speak to someone from your country, even if it's a tiny peek into the newsroom, was very exciting for me. It is something that I have heard about and read about and yet have never known. So I think when people talk, it kind of helps promote understanding. And then you can look for a way forward. So yes, to answer your question, the Parsi community is absolutely critical. They're absolutely symbolic of what can happen when, you know, when two cultures meet. But at the same time, I think India is a large country and so is yours. We need to have more interactions across groups and hope to understand each other better.
One last question before we let you go, Mrs. Kumar. Now, Iran has been strong enough in its cultural foundations to influence outsiders and absorb them. How do you see this important characteristic in the present-day world?
That is such a great question. Yes, I mean, we call it multiculturalism and we call it these fancy words today. But the fact is, I mean, centuries ago, your country was the hub of... you had rulers who were so comfortable ruling over diverse sects of people, right? You had colorful societies where, I don't know, if you walk down a bazaar in those days, you probably see people speaking several languages, dressed differently, eating different kind of things, and still communicating with each other. You know, trade was a facilitator. You learned to cross each other's path and give way and, you know, walk together. So your country is one of those which is culturally so diverse, right? And you kind of, there is this whole pre-Islamic stage, there is this whole integration after that. There is just so many different kind of communities that are kind of living together and learning from each other and changing each other a little bit. And, you know, when you were asking me that question, in my head, I was saying, this is just so similar to how we are as well. India also has had a history of kind of assimilating and absorbing people from various religions, from various geographies, from the West, right up from Afghanistan. We've had travelers and people looking for asylum, and we welcome them. And more recently, of course, from the East as well, Bangladesh. There are millions of Bangladeshis who are currently, who've made India their home. So I think, again, I'm just looking for points of resonance to say, you know, our countries are similar in so many different ways. And when it comes to cultural diversity, to be able to embrace differences, I think, again, they're beautiful stories that need to be told.
There you have it, Mrs. Ekta Kumar, writer and journalist from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, Miss, especially for the energy, passion and happiness. Thank you. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Rez tweeted, "Nowruz is close. Here's a trivia. Which European country celebrates it as Sultan Nowruz Festival, commemorating the birth of Imam Ali, celebrating it over 3 days? Albania. Nowruz is a national holiday." Veladanka Andriva wrote, "With Nowruz just behind the corner, no better time than Sunday afternoon to get our family table centerpiece gonja ready, featuring freshly sprouted samani." John Hawk tweeted, "Bas relief in Persepolis, a symbol in Zoroastrian for Nowruz, eternally fighting bull personifying the moon and a lion personifying the sun representing the spring." Vida Tajik Nia wrote, "I was walking to the lab today and saw this. Spring is here, and if you are Persian, Nowruz is a big deal for you."
And that was our episode about the cultural affinity between Iran and also the subcontinent and how the people of the region celebrate Nowruz festivities with zeal and zest. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Today is the last day of the Iranian year 1401. Interestingly, the start of the new Iranian year and the spring of nature nearly coincide with the start of the spring of the Noble Quran, the blessed month of Ramadan. In view of this, we have prepared a series in 8 parts to briefly dwell upon the traditions of Nowruz in Iran. We hope that you will enjoy this series. Winter has come to the end with all its hardships. The trees are blossoming and the sweet song of birds can be heard everywhere alongside the blowing of the spring breeze. Nowruz has been blended with indelible memories as it corresponds with the revival of nature. No doubt, spring is the most beautiful season of the year. If you happen to travel to Iran in late February and early March, you will experience a different trip. The climate of cities and villages is memorable in these days, as you will see people getting prepared for the coming of spring and Nowruz in a lively manner. You will see some buying new clothes or furniture, while others are engaged in the traditional custom of house cleaning. Even the shopkeepers try to tidy up their shops, and municipalities beautify streets and parks with various items. These are all done to welcome spring and Nowruz. It is noteworthy that Iranians and the adherents of Nowruz in different countries believe that house cleaning is a symbol of cleaning the heart from pollutions, grudges, and evil characteristics. Western travelers have also pointed to the nice custom of house cleaning in Iran before Nowruz. One of them was Jacob Edward Pollack, who lived in early 19th century and had taken a trip to Iran. He has written down his experience of traveling to Iran and says that the Iranian people are busy several days before Nowruz to clean their houses and neighborhood to get ready for the coming of spring. Rich families often change their furniture, while middle-class and low-income families only clean their houses and the existing furniture. Different sources are believed to exist for Nowruz tradition. Some researchers maintain that it has its roots in myths such as the return of the spirits of the dead. Farvahar meant spirit in ancient Iran. Over 4,500 years ago, the Aryan people living in Iran believed that the spirit departs from the body and continues its life somewhere else after death. This was while most of the peoples on planet Earth were engaged in idolatry and maintained that human being is made up of only the physique and there is no metaphysical reality. Farvahar returns in spring to usher in the revival of spirits and new life. Hence, the naming of the first month of the Iranian calendar year is Farvardin. We read in some of the mythical texts that Farvahar will not let the individual alone until he or she is deviated from the right path and is indulged in sins. At that moment, Farvahar will depart the sinner. The tradition of house cleaning or replacing of old utensils and furniture is a kind of welcoming the spirit of the dead in the first days of spring and Nowruz. Islam, as the last divine religion, has emphasized being cleanness. A very famous hadith from the Prophet of Islam reads, "Cleanness is part of faith." It means that being clean is a sign of a faithful. Dear listeners, Iranians maintain another nice custom which has its roots in their religious beliefs. This custom is visiting the graveyards on the last Thursday of the year to recite the Noble Quran and pray for the dead. On this day, cemeteries throughout the country are full of people who are praying for their dead and dusting the tombs of the dead and washing them with water or rose water. Among these graves, the graves of the martyrs are of great significance for the believers, as they were the people who willingly sacrificed their life for the security and comfort of others. Above all, many people try to attend the shrine of a descendant of the Prophet known as Imamzadeh somewhere in their city or nearby. This way, people try to get spirituality from the tomb of that Imamzadeh and start their new year with a tinge of spirituality and attention to God and lofty values. Yet, the busiest place in these days in Iran is the holy mausoleum of Imam Reza, peace upon him, in Mashhad. Millions of lovers rush to Mashhad to perform pilgrimage to the celestial shrine of the Prophet's eighth infallible successor. This way, they pray for all Muslims across the world and seek intercession with Imam Reza, peace upon him, to solve their problems and the problems of Muslims all over the world. We hope that you and we will have a fruitful year and God will be satisfied with us. Amen.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia have risen to unprecedented levels after Washington accused Moscow of colliding with one of its Reaper surveillance drones, forcing it to crash into the Black Sea waters off Crimea. Russia denied it deliberately brought the unmanned aerial vehicle down. Moscow says the drone went down after stalling and never came into contact with another aircraft. Russia says the UAV was flying towards the Russian border without an active transponder in clear violation of the restricted area established for the conduct of the special military operation. Two interceptors were dispatched to investigate. As a result of sharp maneuvers, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle went into uncontrolled flight, lost altitude, and collided with the water surface. The Russian fighters did not use weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home base. That's what the Russian Defense Ministry stated. But the U.S. has rejected Russia's explanation, accusing Russian jets of an unsafe and unprofessional intercept of the drone. U.S. military officials claimed their spy drone was operating in international airspace when a pair of Su-27 jets appeared, sprayed it with fuel, and struck the propeller of the UAV, which caused it to crash into the sea.
But there is a pattern of behavior recently where there is a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We think we haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. And it wasn't just involving us. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has already reached out to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, to discuss the incidents. The last time Shoigu and Austin spoke was in October 2022. The latest incident has further strained the already tense relations between the two nations. Kremlin said on Wednesday that relations with the U.S. were in a lamentable state and at their lowest level. Calls are already growing loud in the U.S. to retaliate against Russia. Hawkish Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested opening fire on Russian fighter jets that intercept U.S. drones.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets.
Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the senator's call to shoot down Russian aircraft went far beyond common sense and risked all-out war between the world's largest nuclear powers. Since Russia started the military operation in eastern Ukraine, contact between American and Russian military leaders has been limited. Meanwhile, Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has said that the drone crash represents a moment of great tension in relations between Moscow and Washington. He also urged the West and Russia to exercise caution so that they could avoid a direct clash. The crisis comes as the war is still raging on in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russian forces must be stopped in Bakhmut and other towns in the east. Russia has said the capturing of Bakhmut opens a path to taking control of the entire Donetsk region, one of its central war aims. Russian forces and fighters from Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut's east, but have apparently failed to encircle the city. NATO also warned last week that Bakhmut could fall within a matter of days.
The United States has suffered some of its biggest bank failures since 2008. Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the U.S., failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. Officials say they acted to protect insured depositors. Regulators have taken control of the lender's deposits and transferred the assets to a newly created entity. Nearly half of the American technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. Moreover, a large number of startups will not be able to make payroll at some point in the next month if they cannot access their money. The lender had been under pressure lately due to fears of recession, higher interest rates, and a slowdown in the market for initial public offerings. The factors had made it harder for startups to raise additional cash. But Silicon Valley Bank was not the only U.S. financial institution to fail. Following the collapse of SVB, customers withdrew more than $10 billion in deposits from New York-based Signature Bank. Regulators have now said that Signature was taken over to protect its depositors and the stability of the U.S. financial system. Signature had 40 branches, assets of $110.36 billion, and deposits of $88.59 billion at the end of 2022. Signature Bank was founded in 2001 as a more business-friendly alternative to the big banks. It expanded to the West Coast and then opened itself to the crypto industry in 2018.
Signature Bank is a business mostly bank with actually pretty good deposits relative to lending. And it closed mainly because I think the same thing we're seeing across the banking industry, sort of a psychology of investors losing faith in the credit quality of banking in general.
And there are a lot of red flags here. That's certainly one of them, the concentration in one industry. the explosive growth over the last year. They literally doubled in size from 100 some odd billion to over 200 billion in assets, catapulting them into one of the largest size echelon of banks in the U.S. They also had a very, as they say in the banking world and accounting, they had a very mismatched portfolio.
The bank failures have sparked fears of contagion in the financial sector, not only in the United States, but also in other countries. Bank shares in the US, Asia and Europe have slumped following the collapse of SVB and Signature Bank. Investors have started to worry about the general state of the banking sector. Smaller US lenders were particularly hard hit. Investors are concerned that the failures are a sign of troubles at other firms. Several pension funds in the US and at least two overseas have lost millions of dollars due to the crisis. Institutions such as the California Public Employees Retirement Fund, the California State Teachers Retirement System, Korea's National Pension Service, and Sweden's Elective Pension Fund had reportedly invested in SVB. Analysts believe Silicon Valley Bank's collapse is likely to be felt across the technology landscape globally over the coming years.
But, you know, you also have the question of the impact on the financial technology and research and development, venture capital industries in the United States. There's $160 billion potentially tied up in this receivership that the venture capital industry could lose.
Governments in the United Kingdom and the United States have taken extraordinary steps to stop a potential banking crisis. The UK Treasury and the Bank of England have announced that they had facilitated the sale of SVB UK to HSBC, Europe's biggest bank, ensuring the security of £6.7 billion of deposits. President Biden has also pledged stiffer bank regulations, forcing regulators to step in with a series of emergency measures.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The crisis has underscored the risks to banks from the end of easy money. Global borrowing costs have risen as the Federal Reserve lifted U.S. rates by 450 basis points from near zero. The European Central Bank hiked the Eurozone's by 300. There are concerns that price inflation will stay high, something that would drive further rate hikes.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia have risen to unprecedented levels after Washington accused Moscow of colliding with one of its Reaper surveillance drones, forcing it to crash into the Black Sea waters off Crimea. Russia denied it deliberately brought the unmanned aerial vehicle down. Moscow says the drone went down after stalling and never came into contact with another aircraft. Russia says the UAV was flying towards the Russian border without an active transponder in clear violation of the restricted area established for the conduct of the special military operation. Two interceptors were dispatched to investigate. As a result of sharp maneuvers, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle went into uncontrolled flight, lost altitude, and collided with the water surface. The Russian fighters did not use weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home base. That's what the Russian Defense Ministry stated. But the U.S. has rejected Russia's explanation, accusing Russian jets of an unsafe and unprofessional intercept of the drone. U.S. military officials claimed their spy drone was operating in international airspace when a pair of Su-27 jets appeared, sprayed it with fuel, and struck the propeller of the UAV, which caused it to crash into the sea.
But there is a pattern of behavior recently where there is a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. And it wasn't just involving us. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has already reached out to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, to discuss the incidents. The last time Shoigu and Austin spoke was in October 2022. The latest incident has further strained the already tense relations between the two nations.
I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart, Minister Shoigu. As I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication. And the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows. And it is incumbent upon Russia to operate its military aircraft in a safe and professional manner.
Kremlin said on Wednesday that relations with the U.S. were in a lamentable state, and at their lowest level, calls are already growing loud in the U.S. to retaliate against Russia. Hawkish Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested opening fire on Russian fighter jets that intercept U.S. drones.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets.
Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the senator's call to shoot down Russian aircraft went far beyond common sense and risked all-out war between the world's largest nuclear powers. Since Russia started the military operation in eastern Ukraine, contact between American and Russian military leaders has been limited. Meanwhile, Italy's foreign minister, Antonio Tajani, has said that the drone crash represents a moment of great tension in relations between Moscow and Washington. He also urged the West and Russia to exercise caution so that they could avoid a direct clash. The crisis comes as the war is still raging on in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russian forces must be stopped in Bakhmut and other towns in the east. Russia has said the capturing of Bakhmut opens a path to taking control of the entire Donetsk region, one of its central war aims.
Wagner PMC units have practically surrounded Bakhmut. Only one road is left open to Ukrainian forces. The pincers are getting tighter. If earlier the professional Ukrainian army fought with us, today we see more and more old people and children.
Russian forces and fighters from Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut's east, but have apparently failed to encircle the city. NATO also warned last week that Bakhmut could fall within a matter of days.
China's President Xi Jinping has pledged to bolster the country's security and build the military into a great wall of steel to defend Beijing's interests.
So as to guarantee a new development pattern through a new security architecture, we should further advance our mobilization drive in terms of national defense and military, and to turn China's military into a great wall of steel that will effectively defend the country's sovereignty, security, and development interests.
He also stressed the need for an improved national security system as well as an improved social governance system.
Security is the foundation for development. Stability is the prerequisite for prosperity. We should implement a holistic approach to national security and improve our national security system, strengthen our capacity for safeguarding national security, and enhance public safety governance, as well as to improve the social governance system.
He also reiterated Beijing's opposition to secessionist activities and external interference in Taiwan. Xi's remarks came in his closing speech to China's parliament, the National People's Congress, where last week he secured unanimous support for an unprecedented third term in office. During his speech, Xi also said China must achieve greater self-resilience and strength in science and technology, a call that comes as the United States blocks China's access to chip-making equipment and other cutting-edge technologies. Meanwhile, China's premier has said some people in the U.S. have been trumpeting decoupling from China in recent years.
I know that in recent years, some in the United States have been trumpeting the idea of decoupling from China, and sometimes it could become quite a hot topic on the media. But I wonder how many people can truly benefit from this kind of hype. According to Chinese statistics, two-way trade between China and the United States last year totaled $760 billion, which again set a new record in history.
Kyung said China and the United States can't and must cooperate, and there are a lot that the two countries can achieve by working together. He stressed that encirclement and suppression are in no one's interests. The latest remarks by Xi Jinping regarding China's focus on security comes as relations with the U.S. have hit their lowest point in decades. Chinese officials had previously warned that Washington's efforts to contain Beijing's interests could lead to conflict and confrontation between the two superpowers. America's increasingly confrontational posture toward China is a significant shift in the U.S. foreign policy that needs greater scrutiny and debate. For most of the past half century, the United States sought to reshape China through economic and diplomatic engagement. In the case of the Trump administration, through economic and diplomatic disengagement. The Biden administration, by contrast, has shelved the idea that China can be changed in favor of the hope that it can be checked. The White House has moved to limit economic ties with China, to limit China's access to technology with military applications, to pull back from international institutions where the United States has long sought to engage China, and to strengthen ties with China's neighbors. In recent months, the United States has restricted semiconductor exports to China, and this week, it moved ahead with plans to help Australia obtain nuclear submarines. The administration also is seeking to impose new restrictions on American investments in certain Chinese companies. In treating China as a growing threat to American interests, it is acting with broad support, including from leading Republicans, much of the military and foreign policy establishments, and a growing portion of the business community. China also is demonstrating a greater willingness to engage in worrying provocations, mounting military displays in the South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. China and the U.S. have locked themselves into a new cycle of recriminations, provoking fresh worries that the world's two biggest economies are heading down a path that could one day lead to the once unthinkable, the possibility of open conflict. The dueling narratives brought into focus how the U.S. and China increasingly have one thing in common, a growing distrust of the other side. Even worse, the escalating rhetoric is entrenching divisions that could make it harder for both sides to find a way to coexist peacefully over the long term.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا مقلب القلوب والأبصار
O rotator of hearts and eyes
يا مدبر الليل والنهار
O regulator of the day and night
يا محول الحول والأحوال
O transformer of the state and conditions
حول حالنا إلى أحسن الحال
Turn our state into the best of states Happy New Iranian Calendar Year. Happy Nowruz.
In the limelight.
The latest round of protests against the French President Emmanuel Macron's government's pension reforms took place on Thursday, 16th of March, in almost every major French city. The protests led to violent clashes between protesters and the police. Many are now asking why the French government seems to have no money for pensioners, while it has funds for military aid to Ukraine. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. U.S. broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. French President Emmanuel Macron ordered his prime minister to wield a special constitutional power on Thursday, 16th of March, that skirts Parliament to force through a highly unpopular bill raising the retirement age in France from 62 to 64 without a vote in the French Parliament. His calculated risk using Article 49.3 of the Constitution to skip a vote on the reform measures set off a clamour among lawmakers who began singing the national anthem even before Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne arrived in the lower house of the French Parliament. Elizabeth Borne spoke forcefully over their shouts, acknowledging that President Macron's unilateral move will trigger quick motions of no confidence in his government. The fury over opposition lawmakers echoed the anger of citizens and workers' unions. Thousands gathered in an unplanned protest at Place de la Concorde, facing the National Assembly, lighting a bonfire. As night fell, French police fired tear gas canisters and charged the demonstrators in waves to clear the area. Small groups of those chased away moved through nearby streets in the Chic neighbourhood, setting streets on fire. French police said at least 120 people were detained. According to French media, similar scenes repeated themselves in numerous other French cities, including Rennes and Nantes in the east, to Lyon and the southern port city of Marseille, where shop windows and bank fronts were smashed. Radical leftist groups were blamed for the latest destructive acts. The unions that have organised strikes and marches since January, leaving Paris reeking in piles of garbage, announced new rallies and protest marches in the days ahead. They declared, "This retirement reform is brutal, unjustified for the world of workers." French unions called for another day of strikes and industrial action against the reform on 23rd of March. Opinion polls show that a vast majority of voters in France oppose the pension reform, as do trade unions, who say there are other ways to balance the accounts, including taxing the wealthy more. The government's move is likely to further enrage unions, protesters and left-wing opposition parties, who say the pension overhaul is unfair and unnecessary. The head of the French Socialist Party, Olivier Faure, told Reuters news agency earlier on Thursday, 16th of March, that it could unleash uncontrollable anger after weeks of rolling strikes and protests that have hit power production, blocked some shipments from refineries, and seen garbage pile up on the streets of the French capital, Paris. CGT unionist Christophe Joannou, at a refinery on strike in the western French city of Donges, said, "We're as determined as ever. From next week on, we will take things up a gear." Opposition parties said they would request a vote of no confidence in the French government, which will be voted on in the coming days. Meanwhile, the British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. French unions called for a show of force, with a final day of strikes and protests in the run-up to a crucial vote on President Emmanuel Macron's fiercely contested pension overhaul in the French Parliament. The call for an eighth day of national mobilisation on Wednesday, 22nd of March, comes as rubbish piles up in Paris and a number of other French cities, after continuing strikes by refuse collectors who oppose the bill that will increase the official retirement age in France from 62 to 64. Record numbers of demonstrators have taken to the streets of France over the past few weeks to oppose proposed changes to the pension system, which President Macron promised to carry out in his re-election campaign last year. The legislation would not only raise the retirement age in France, but also increase the number of years of contributions needed to claim a full pension. Opinion polls suggest up to 70% of the French people oppose the changes to the pension system. The same opinion poll found 56% of those asked considered protesters and strikers were justified in bringing France to a standstill in the run-up to Thursday's 23rd of March vote. Meanwhile, in a survey held after the French government passed the controversial pension reform without a vote in the French National Assembly, 71% of the respondents said they wanted the government to resign. US research organization Harris Interactive for the French media asked the French people for their opinion on the government after Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne decided to pass the pension reform without voting by activating the third paragraph of Article 49 of the French Constitution on Thursday. In the online survey conducted with 1,002 people aged over the age of 18, 49% were supporters of President Emmanuel Macron's party, and 82% of respondents said using Article 49 to push through the controversial pension reform was bad. The survey showed that if the opposition puts a motion of no confidence on the table, 71% of the French public want it to be accepted and they want the government to resign. On the other hand, even if the draft law on reform was accepted, 65% of the participants expressed an opinion in favour of continuing mass demonstrations and strikes against pension reform. France's Transport Minister, Clément Beaune, said there would be disruption to public transport and flights, but it was unlikely to be a Black Wednesday. Clément Beaune said there should not be the same level of disruption as with previous mobilizations. The upper house of the French Parliament, the Senate, approved the bill on Saturday, 11th of March, sending it back to the National Assembly. Union leaders and opposition MPs are furious that a 28-member cross-party parliamentary commission that will thrash out a final compromise on the bill will meet behind closed doors on Wednesday. Mathilde Panot of the radical left La France Insoumise, or France Unbowed Party, which tabled 13,000 amendments to the bill in an attempt to halt it, told the parliamentary channel, "It's interesting that at a time when many aspects of the bill haven't been discussed, that citizens can know what is going on." About 6,600 tons of rubbish was estimated to have built up in the streets of Paris on Tuesday, 14th of March, as the city's refuse collectors voted to continue their strike action until Monday, 20th of March. The powerful CGT union said in a statement that workers in refuse, water, sewage and sanitation sectors of the city of Paris would be stepping up their industrial action. If the commission agrees on a final text, the bill will return to the French Senate for approval on Thursday morning before being sent back to the Assemblée Nationale for a final vote that afternoon. Analysts say it is a high-risk week for President Emmanuel Macron, whose credibility depends on the legislation going through the parliament, but who is facing an additional challenge as his centrist government failed to win an absolute majority in parliamentary elections last June. This leaves it with the choice of doing deals with MPs from the right-wing Les Républicains or forcing the bill through using a constitutional tool called 49.3. A measure that avoids a National Assembly vote, it risks losing. French ministers have said the government would not use the 49.3 option, widely condemned as undemocratic and which risks inflaming a volatile public mood. Instead, there has been a flurry of negotiations by ministers to guarantee a majority in the lower house of the French Parliament. Union leaders have said using the 49.3 would lead to a hardening of opposition and would escalate strike action in France. The pension system is the keystone of France's social model, but is complicated and expensive. Attempts since the 1990s to overhaul it have caused nationwide protests and brought the country to a standstill.
economic divide.